Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
My guest is a board-certified psychiatrist, educator of family doctors in training at Stanford's Family Medicine Residency, and longtime meditator and meditation teacher. Dr. Greg Sasma is a survivor of a rare bone cancer who has used meditation to deal with his own medical crisis. He uses lessons from his experiences to show why and how meditation works. He has now written a book, Practical Mindfulness, A Physician's No-Nonsense Guide to Meditation for Beginners. In addition to his clinical teaching and writing work, Dr. Sasma serves on the boards of directors of Snowline Hospice and Capital Public Radio. Dr. Greg Sasma, welcome.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Now, there are a lot of meditation books out there. So how is your book different?
Yes. My initial drive to write this book was because I've read a lot of those books over the last 20 years. And while I think there's a lot to be said for a lot of the resources that are out there, both secular as well as spiritual, I had the idea as I was reading them many times, and maybe it's a pet peeve, that sometimes books can be written in a way that can be, especially in this genre, that can be esoteric, sometimes have lots of psychobabble or new age gewgaws and frou-frou. My father-in-law used to refer to as that. It's a French term for, I guess, upholstery, little knobs or something. That you know, sort of just make it harder to understand. And especially in learning this technique, which is trainable, but also this interior tactic of training our self-awareness, people can get lost in it. They can get troubled by the esoterica, in the sense that maybe it is leaning towards some sort of spiritual sense. And my thought was, boy, this could be written in a way that's more accessible, simpler, and be a real resource for individuals, but also for doctors to refer to patients and caregivers to give to patients, as well as teachers for themselves and for their students. So I was hoping to write the referral book that would sort of give meditation without all of that other stuff. The punchline in the book is nuts and bolts without the crystals and granola, so to speak.
Well, early in your book, you say that your intention is to get us thinking about our own individual experiences in a novel way, a fresh view that echoes the way meditation operates most effectively without preconceptions. And you say that you want us to get us thinking about our own individual experiences. And if I were wanting to learn to meditate, I would want to learn from you, a longtime meditator, because my interest in meditation goes back to the very early 70s. I was on campus and I saw the sign saying, learn transcendental meditation. I said, boy, that's what I want to do. So I signed up, and these people were so young, they couldn't possibly have had long experience with meditation. And I'm sure they were delighted when my training ended, because I was so full of questions that they couldn't answer. It was just like they had a recorder and I would ask a question and they would just repeat whatever they had been taught. So I appreciate the fact that you yourself are a longtime meditator. So what you bring to your students is based on your own experiences, right?
It is. Although I got to say that my initial introduction to this was in not either a deep spiritual dive or, nor a great educational aspect, but really started without a lot of spirit to it, but as a tactic. In the early part of the book, I talk about my first kind of introduction to it was learning some basic meditation tactics based off of breath meditation that we were trying to include in a chronic disease management program that I was working with my colleagues at the Stanford Family Medicine Program in San Jose. and just seeing it as another way for folks who had chronic pain syndromes and diabetes and hypertension, some other stuff, to see whether some ways of self-care would and self-awareness would improve that. And it was mostly based on, you know, readings I had done and research, but not a lot of personal experience. And it wasn't miraculous, but it was certainly remarkable to see how much more autonomy and control the patients had when they felt like they had a little control over, not necessarily the suffering they had, but their reaction or their relationship to the suffering they had. And that really started me to think about, well, what might that do for the patients I'm working with in my own private practice in psychiatry? And then individually, I mean, I was also in a moment of sort of seeking around what would this do to learn more about it and get deeper into it. So I jumped into it a little bit after getting other people to do it. There's an old medical phrase or a trope that you teach one, you see one, do one, then teach one. And I'm not sure I followed that order, because I sort of taught one and then did one and then taught one. And then I guess I've been doing it a lot in the last 10 years with the whole medical stuff I've been doing. But yeah, it's been an interesting pathway. And I think in the end, the accreted knowledge of a lot of meditating, a lot of deep dives into study of it over the last 20 years got me to the point where I was saying, not only I think I know enough to not be a poser in teaching this to others, and then my own sense of wanting to have a book that doesn't sound like guess what I'm thinking or academies or ways that sometimes these books come across as more self-congratulatory than really truly helpful in teaching. That was my aim in doing it.
My guest is Dr. Greg Sazema, and he has written A Physician's Guide to No Nonsense Guide to Meditation for Beginners. And I think that probably you get people who maybe have tried meditation unsuccessfully, and so they consider themselves a beginner. How do you encourage somebody who feels like they're just not getting anywhere?
I think the biggest early obstacle is that, and it's an ironic one, because meditation is meant to be a fly on the wall examination of your experience in the moment without any added spin, without any added judgment. John Kabat-Zinn, who's sort of the godfather of bringing meditative techniques from the East to the West, he was and still is a psychologist at the University of Massachusetts, and wrote probably the seminal book in the 70s that drove a lot of this stuff coming forward, called Wherever You Go, There You Are, and another book called Full Catastrophe Living. His definition of mindfulness is moment-to-moment non-judgmental awareness. And so if you unpack that, the moment-to-moment makes sense. It's not some other time or before or in the future, but right now, and being aware of it, which a lot of people think of as thinking about it, but it's really a different capacity than thinking. And I can get into that in a little bit if you want. But then the other part is non-judgmental. And that sneaks in really easily, because we can't help but judge everything. I mean, we're just judgment machines. If we have a phenomena of mind, we usually have some at least plus minus aspect of, is that good or bad, or even more grayscale. And what does that mean to me? How does it compare to my other experiences? So I think one of the early problems, to get back to your question, is that people start, and it's hard, because when you open to don't think about things, just watch them come up, or even just as simple as start with one thing and watch it, and then inevitably watch your attention on that one thing. It's usually breathing in and out as the first object of awareness. You can't help but think, wow, I stink at this. Or my mind is so full that it's bouncing all over. I must not be very good at it. Which of course is a judgment, judging of your own training in trying not to be judgmental, which is a kind of twisty thing. My initial reaction, or my initial approach in both the book and when I teach both adults and kids is it's not supposed to be about whether it's any, whether you feel like it's great or not. You're going to have days that'll get clearer and other days where your mind is pea soup. And that's just the way, what you get. It's each moment is a moment just to be aware of that and practice at pulling the attention back when it gets lost, over and over, lather, rinse, repeat. And of course, there is got to be some striving because it can't just sort of float into space and have no wish or confidence or expectations will get better. But maybe the one time I'll use the term faith here is that have some faith that with practicing the idea of I'm breathing, I'm breathing, I'm breathing, I'm going to that radio interview, I'm breathing, I'm breathing. What is she going to ask me? Breathing. You know, after you kind of keep practicing losing it and then pulling it back without holding a grand jury about it, you do start getting better at it. You start witnessing that, oh, there goes my mind into what I'm supposed to be doing tomorrow, what I did yesterday. Or here's what happens just as my mind gets chattered with this thought led to this stuff and this whole cycle. So, I mean, there's a patterning there about go easy on yourself about it. It's not meant to be an apology for not ever working hard at it. But I think the judgment's the biggest deal at the beginning. I mean, there's so many times when I've taught my seminar class. I have a classroom in my office space where the first week, you know, you give the instructions and then some people don't even come back next week, or they call and they say, I couldn't do it. My mind was too full. And I say, welcome. I mean, that's just the way minds are. And it gets better with practice and with a continuing, not just, oh, I'll keep my mind clearer, but what do you do when it isn't? Because I think it's also a great preparation in terms of adaptation to stuff that isn't easy, adaptation to not having a great meditation moment. It teaches humility in that sense as well. And these are all, features and capacities that we all benefit from having.
Well, I have to admit, I was a miserable failure at seated meditation. I tried it. Quite disciplined about it.
You just did. No, go ahead.
But what I found that if I took a physical route, I started doing yoga, mm-hmm. and learned how to relax my body, which in turn helped me relax my mind. And I was always such an inflexible person that when my first yoga teacher said, you should teach yoga. And my reaction was, me? I'm so stiff, years of tennis, and I'm just not flexible enough. But I stayed with it and eventually was asked to come in with the local version of Jon Kabat-Zinn's mindfulness-based stress reduction at the Enloe Medical Center. And I would come in and lead the yoga portion of that series. And I found that that's what I had to do to, oh, this is what it feels like to meditate. And I'm sure I'm
good
not the
work.
Only one.
Just no, but I mean that's great that you stuck with it and then literally turned what felt like a lack of capacity or something that you many of us would say, well, that's not my game, so I'm not going to push it, and instead worked with it and became a teacher. So that's great. I mean, I felt sort of the same way in starting to learn this because I'm a fairly neck up person in terms of the whole idea of cogitating and analyzing and all that stuff. So
I lived in my head.
Yeah.
The first decade.
And and in a lot of ways, one of the recurring tweaks or lessons in the book is whenever you feel like you're spinning with a lot of ruminative thinking and cogitation, pull back and drop into some breaths into what the body feels like and what the emotional tone is, what I usually refer to as the heart or the weather inside. But back to your other point, mindfulness is, the capacity to be aware, and meditation is the training. And that can take all sorts of different ways. So sitting meditation isn't for everybody because sometimes people just physiologically either aren't comfortable with it because they're more, neurologically restless. For others, it hurts too much. And for others, they're more likely to be able to use the physicality as the anchor. You know, in basic meditation, it's generally we pick some aspect of experience and practice on that, and then hopefully spread it out so that you can use that as a jumping off point to spread out from, say, the breath to the whole body, and then to emotional tones, and then to, you know, sitting and watching thoughts as they pop and go without grabbing one and running with it. But there's nothing wrong at all with using mindful movement practices as the anchor rather than, say, the breath. So, you know, Tai Chi, Qigong, yoga, even just a mindful walk, where the point is, I'm going to keep my mind on this experience of motion, and as it leaves, I bring it back. And it's really potent, and it's not just metaphoric. It truly is neurologic. I was in a retreat about 10 years ago, and the group I work with called Clear Mountain Wisdom in Auburn, California, you know, we'll have these 3-day and sometimes longer retreats. And between sittings, which are usually about half an hour, we usually do some Qigong, which I used to think of as sort of Buddhist calisthenics. But it was, you know, it really was both to continue the work of staying plugged into this is a practice of awareness, but using motion instead. And one week or one meditation retreat, a fellow came down who was a Qigong master, as they told him. And he was a really interesting fellow. He worked at University of Washington with paraplegics. And, you know, I asked him, you know, it's in silence, but, you know, after the thing was done, I talked to him. So that doesn't sound like you can do that, because with paraplegics, they can't move. Too bad. And it's an awful thing to have. And he said, no, it's really amazing, because our study is putting EEGs on them. And they will get energetic lighting up of the brain, just like yours will, just by imagining moving the arms. So, you know, the experience of, you know, the Eastern idea of chi moving through arms and legs and up the central channel and the different chakras and all the ways in Eastern medicine, all that stuff has its models in Western medicine as well. And there's better ways of measuring it now. And even somebody where they couldn't physically move their arms, their imagination of doing the practice was just as potent for them in terms of what it was doing to brainwaves and things like that.
I had a student who understood what you just described. She happened to have been a nurse, and she was in an automobile accident in the Bay Area, and she was not able to move. But when she was able to drive, she said, I'm going to come to class. Said, I won't be able to, very little I'll be able to do, but I'm going to participate as you describe the poses and as the rest of the class does them. And so she understood what you just described.
Yeah.
My guest is psychiatrist and author, Dr. Greg Sizema, and he has written a book, Practical Mindfulness, A Physician's No-Nonsense Guide to Meditation for Beginners. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Dr. Greg Sizema, who has written a book on practical mindfulness, And Dr. Zazima, I think perhaps I should spell your name since it is rather unusual. It's S-A-Z-I-M-A.
That's now, true. They added the I at Ellis Island, I'm told, just to complicate things for us. We were on vacation in New York, and I'm looking it up, you know, at Ellis Island. I'm like, why didn't it could have been so simple? But anyway.
So
something to meditate on. Yes.
Dr. Greg.
Go with Zazima. Greg. How's that? That's easier. Yeah.
Dr. Greg Zazima is a psychiatrist who teaches meditation, a longtime meditator himself, and teaches meditation. And he has written a book for beginners. Now, I mentioned familiarity with Jon Kabat-Zinn's books, but you introduced some ideas that are not a part of his instruction. You have this term wavicle, W-A-V-I-C-L-E. And would you explain to us why you introduced this concept?
Yes, some people have said that is the least practical thing to put in a book about practical mindfulness. But I've been drawn to and also wanting to attract those who look at meditation as a purely kind of mystical or esoteric idea, and wanted to bring in at least the metaphoric, if not the true idea, that beneath this experience we have of ourselves moving through life as separate selves, there's now a kind of reciprocal consensus among both people in physics as well as people in spiritual practices about a kind of unity. And if you can imagine in a spiritual realm, and in most spiritual realms, most of the major franchises of religion have an idea of, in the end, a unity of spirit, of grace, of connection. You can find a parallel process in, of all things, quantum physics, which talks about the idea that matter and waveform are really just two forms of the same kind of energy, whether that is, crystallized, so to speak, into matter, or it disperses into waveform. And in fact, I think there's a quote near the end of the book where it talks about ourselves as temporary coalitions of energy, which is a little bit impractical, but I think it gets the idea of the fact that from a standpoint of the latest physics, you know, string theory and quantum physics, we're all connected in the terms of being energetic and forms of energy that are not disconnected from each other. But you can't really live that way because we live in a separate self world, even though our separate selves that we look at in the world and we look at in the mirror are constructions of ourselves. And so back to wavicle was my way of looking at, well, we are kind of connected all together. And there is some argument that when people get into deeper states of meditative awareness, where the self kind of drops away in experience, what is that? What are we actually sensing and experiencing? And is that possibly that, you know, concurrent with our sense of here's Greg and his Gregness going and doing his Greg thing, and Nancy's doing her Nancy-ness. There's also this other undercurrent hum of everything being together. Wavicle then becomes this, I guess it's a bumper sticker. I guess it's just a nickname for the idea that things are both wave and particle, wavicle. And so when I'm talking in the book about, we drop beneath the sort of stuff that keeps connecting or keeps distracting us, we can drop into, and this is more in part three of the book when we get past the beginner's part into, so what is this thing when you experience kind of a unity consciousness when you're on a hike or when you're in love or when you have a spiritual experience or other forms of this? And my own perception after studying lots of people's descriptions of this, because it's all intersubjective in a sense, is that people feel it in some familiar ways. They usually feel it as a self dropping away. They usually feel it in a kind of fuzziness of borders between self and other. And there's a feeling not of alienation, but of belonging about it. And so I use wavicles as sort of a shorthand for what happens in mind. And we don't know, you know, to what extent it's wave and what sense it's particle, but it's something there that we pick up on. And I meant it to be sort of a clever way of saying you sciencey types can join into.
Well, it did make perfect sense to me. So I appreciated your introducing that term wavicle. My guest is Dr. Greg Sazema, and he is a meditator himself, and he instructs meditation. His book is Practical Mindfulness, A Physician's No-Nonsense Guide to Meditation for Beginners. Now, you do say in your title that it's a no-nonsense guide, but you, a moment ago, used the word chakra. And I think a lot of people say, oh, chakra, now there you're getting a little hairy-fairy on me. But I right. find that's a very clear, in my own mind, way of organizing this energy through the body. And so I find that concept of chakras makes a lot of sense for me.
Well, that's good. And I did include that, you know, for some, it's perceived as a metaphor of sequential areas of places to place your awareness, frankly, in the body. Eastern medicine posits that there really are subtle energy centers that take nodes that go up and down the spine, and there's seven of them. And enough people have heard about it that it made sense to say, well, let me try to frame my own way of looking at this. And so there is, like with the rest of the book, just to go into some overall detail, there's three sections of the book. Kind of an introductory section that both explains what mindfulness and meditation is in prose, and then exercises on the most basic stuff, breath meditation. And then a second section that looks into the aspects of experience, body, heart, mind, and awareness, sort of the big four. And then the space around it, which we kind of don't necessarily identify, but we can experience as either kind of clear or muddy. And then practices with that, and chakra practices are included in that. So in each section of the book, there is a prose section, and then there's sort of the exercises, a little bit like a workbook, but I wanted to get people meditating. So I didn't want to just section it off into a, you know, a kind of a prose part and then a workbook part. So each section sort of pings back and forth from thinking to doing. And then in that second section, because I go into physical and emotional and thought aspects of it, I find that the chakra model, maybe I should go into a little detail for folks on that. So in Eastern medicine, chakras are thought to be that there are subtle energy pathways in the body that aren't really easily measured by current, at least by even now current technology, although there's better ways of measuring it than it used to be, but they've been perceived for centuries. And they really go from the rootedness of the base first chakra to creativity of the second chakra, which is located around private parts, to the gut chakra, which is really around, which can be associated both with the physical gut, but also perceptions of threat and anxiety and rooted and sort of belonging, and then up to the heart, and then the throat, and then the head, and then out through the top. So each of these have an association, but to both a somatic area of the body and kind of an emotional tone that goes with it. And then also a kind of aspiration through all of that. And there's more details in the book. That's just a way to get you to go click. But I mean, there are ways of sort of then love in a lovely way, marrying these things in a kind of sequential, I'm going to sit with rootedness, but I also think that's not just how does the bottom of my body feel, but also what's my sense of being grounded in my family, in my faith, in my work? What's my sense of sort of being secure? And you can take each of the chakras and sort of apply an emotional and cognitive and aware lesson to each one of them. You know, the throat chakra, which is often associated with communication and whether you're being heard and whether your sense of your own mattering is projected into the world. I mean, so these things will pop up in the middle of sort of walking through these sequentially in meditation. That's just an example of it.
Well, sometimes when people doubt say this concept of chakras just doesn't make sense to them, I say, well, have you ever been hiking through the mountains and you get close to the edge of a precipice? Do you feel something in your body? Because I feel at the base of my spine goes tingling, like, don't take another step because your survival depends on this. So that's something that I think people might have experienced if they think about it, the base of the spine, or they see a baby or a puppy and I don't see how they can't help but feel that in the middle of their chest, which is the fourth chakra, the heart chakra, and that it stirs that. And you mentioned the gut. You know, we even have expressions that had a gut feeling.
Right.
So these concepts, I think, could be helpful. I think you mentioned acupuncture that also deals with these energy systems in the body.
Yeah, there's different things that there's acupressure, there's emotional freedom technique of sort of tapping. I mean, these are all alternative complementary medicine practices that have gotten a little bit more attention in the last 20 years. Yes.
And you just mentioned that some of these things have gotten more attention in the last 20 years. This kind of stress reduction is often labeled stress relief. I opened this month's Costco magazine, and there's an article in there about stress relief. And the doctor, he's an oncologist, happens to have written the article, but he describes focusing on breath, breathe in as you count to four slowly, hold your breath for four, breathe out for 4 seconds, hold for four, and to repeat that. Now, that's in just an ordinary magazine. And so I think people are more aware of what you're presenting and might say, maybe I should give this a try. So how do you, for your readers, how do you get them started? Say, okay, here's what I propose for you.
I don't want to make it sound like a sales job, but if I did, I guess if it's sure. Costco, I'd first have to offer them something in a small plastic cup. all right, I'll be here all week. Anyway, so I think of, a couple of things popping into mind. First of all, is pushing back a little bit on it just being stress relief, because I think there's aspects of how we manage this stuff that is about, let me call it band-aids and vitamins. In other words, reactive tactics when we're suffering to help reduce the suffering, which is necessary and absolutely helpful. And then trying to get in front of these things with practices that allow us to be more resilient and adaptive. That's what I mean by vitamins. So I think meditation serves both of those purposes in that when you're sitting and you've wrestled back and forth with, I had a fight with a coworker yesterday, and every time I sit to watch my breath, my mind goes, why didn't I say that? Or why did they say it to me? And then pulling it back and just witnessing instead of running the narrative, what does this feel like right now? There is, just by sheer repetition and experience of watching that, there's this experience and it comes and goes, what Buddhists would call impermanence, the sort of coming and going of all phenomena, we stop freaking out about it so much. There's an adaptive quality to it. So there's that quality of being able to off the cushion then manage experiences because you've had enough time sort of running it through your own obstacle course to recognize I sat with that a number of times. This is how that usually goes with me, and it'll land this way. So there's an after the fact band-aid aspect of it. I think secondly, I try to talk to people about that meditation is really like a vitamin in a way, especially when you get into a regular practice. And for me, especially in the mornings, it sets a kind of tone about, this is the way I'm going to try to approach my world today. And it may not go that way, right? Because, you know, we just don't have that kind of predictive power about the world. But that same adaptability gives a kind of confidence going forward to stay in a certain lane instead of just being in a kind of reactive state. If I had to throw a third one in there, I think it's around that it sets a kind of ecosystem for our experience, especially when people do some practices that involve not just that kind of meditation, but some meditations on some of the aspirational qualities of being human. That is meditating on gratitude, validation of others, equity, just a thankfulness for the stuff that we have. It sets a state, I think, a kind of a state of mind that is much more preferable than the alternative. I know just in terms of my daily clinical practice, even if I only have a minute or two, I try to sit with some compassion practice, just 10 breaths of in, me, out, try to do best I can for others, because I'm lucky to be here. And it cultivates a kind of attitude and mind that I think we really need right now. You know, you're reading a lot of this stuff in so many magazines because, you know, we've been talking in isolation, but the last 2 years have been, I've been using this term, and I think it might be a little bit hyperbolic, but a kind of societal trauma. I don't think it's hyperbolic when you think about how many people have died and how many people have lost and how many people are sick and continuing to be sick, and just all of the other rigors of an irritable moment in our kind of contemporary lives. I think trying to figure out a way to cope with it is never been more important.
After a break, I'll be back with my guest, Dr. Greg Sazema, who has written a practical mindfulness guide to meditation for beginners. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with Dr. Greg Sazema, who has written a physician's no-nonsense guide to meditation for beginners. The title is Practical Mindfulness. And the actor-narrator Peter Coyote has a book out on meditation now, and he has the Buddha describe how you're supposed to sit, and it's rather strict. How you sit, what your spine, what you do with your hands, and you.
Yeah, that's fine. No, I've studied all the different ways to do it, and you're supposed to put your tongue on your upper palate, but not too far back because that doesn't complete the. Yeah, you know, all that stuff I worry just scares people away. In the early on in the book, there is a whole chapter on that stuff, because I haven't seen that many books that get into that kind of detail. They usually say, sit down and breathe and everything will be great. But they never say about your knees aching after about the first 5 minutes and all the other stuff that doesn't. Yes. How do you sit on a cushion so that it doesn't make your back hurt and stuff like that? Maybe I'm splitting the difference here, but I think there's some ways to do it. But the main thing is find something that allows you to be comfortable, but not sliding into somnolence, and mostly to keep your back straight in ways you can. And if you can't do that, you can lay down and do it. I have friends that have terrible backs and they lie flat, or they just walk back and forth, because it really is not about the physical experience. And like you said, yoga is a meditative practice, but it's, you're focusing on the experience of the pose, the experience of the physical self as you're moving through something. And that's perfectly fine to use as an anchor. So this other stuff about whether you make, you know, shadow animals with your fingers, or where do you put your hands, and do you look, keep your eyes closed or half open or half lidded? That's the part that gets me a little bit like, come on, let's just, it's not absolutely necessary. And the more important thing is to find your own way that allows you to be in a zone, get in and sustain a practice, because it's almost like dieting. I mean, if you get frustrated after the first 2 weeks, you're just done. So you have to find a way to kind of keep it rolling.
Well, you use two adjectives to describe your position. And that's a very way, Patanjali was not writing in English, but a few hundred years ago, this Patanjali, Indian, wrote a book, and he didn't tell us how to do yoga asanas. He wrote a lot of very concise information, but that's what he said, what you said, a position that's comfortable, but not so comfortable you would doze off. In other words, attentiveness and comfort. And so that's what I'm hearing you saying, that that's the position you choose, one where you can be comfortable, but still be attentive.
Yeah. And that experience of whatever is the ideal or, you know, sort of the most optimal sense of being tuned in, it's almost like being on a balance beam, and you sort of kind of shift left and right and front forward until you find the space. In terms of what are the, you know, do I do better sitting in a chair? If so, you know, how do you do that? I mean, most people think if you're sitting in a chair, that's fine, but make sure you're not slumping and have both feet on the ground, because there's a sense of rootedness about having our feet flat on the ground instead of folded. You know, you don't have to go Gumby with your legs, but usually it's useful if you're sitting on a cushion to be sort of tilted downwards, because your lower back won't hurt. I mean, these are really practical things, but they're intersubjective experiences of people for, you know, what I think it's 3,000 years now since there's been reputed people doing meditation practice. And you know, we can use that collective wisdom, but then you know, customize your own ride.
Well, now there's a term that comes up rather frequently in your book, and that's metta, M-E-T-A. And you have, one time you mentioned, keep a metta eye on something, or a quick metta flash at. So how do you find that concept helpful? And what is it?
Yeah, thank you for asking, because I think that's a sort of feature of meditation that I wanted to really emphasize in the book, besides lowering the bar to starting it, is and not trying to aspire to some sort of spiritual greatest of all time state, which they're kind of comic when you meet people who are like, I was able to reach nirvana twice today and before breakfast. But so metta, I was kind of being a little bit cutesy with it, because there's actually a Sanskrit word, metta, M-E-T-T-A, which is really meant to be about a deep experience of connectedness. But metta, as I'm using it, is the way we mostly hear. And I used it before Mark Zuckerberg stole it from me. So I hear he's loaded. So maybe I'll sue. Anyway, but metta, you know, in common parlance now, is something about it, something about something. So metta, I'm trying to think of an example outside of mine. Metta music is writing, is playing music about some other music. Metta writing is, you know, writing about other writing. So metta awareness is actually this state of us being aware of being aware. And lest I've just confused everybody, a prime part of what starts to happen in meditation is you start practicing on a phenomenon like your breathing, and then maybe your heartbeat, and then your whole body. But I think, and this is something that sort of separates me from a lot of some of the other books that I've read about it, is that way down the road, people start thinking about, or these teachings talk about, at some point, you're going to try to move back to becoming aware of the apparatus you have, the capacity of being aware. We can call it your mind's eye or, you know, whatever, but it's that state of being aware. And that's a capacity, that's the very thing we're training in meditation. And so at some point you can step back and observe that as well. Or actually I would say at some point you're already observing that, but you haven't really paid a lot of attention to it. So for me, metta is not just, here's my breathing practice and it's going in and out, but I can also make a judgment of what's this like being me witnessing it? What's the quality of the witnessing itself? And that's a separate capacity that as we get, you sort of rest in that. Think of that. That's your sitting spot, is this experience, this capacity I have to be aware. And it too has qualities that go from cloudy to really clear to sticking with it to bouncing in and out a lot. So what oftentimes in books are talked about is stability, or how long you keep it, and clarity, or how tight and sharp and clear it is, both of those qualities. And metta is just a nickname for that, because most books don't really call it anything other than your awareness or your mind's eye.
Well, I think until people start looking at some of these concepts you present, they're not aware of how often they are not aware, are not paying attention. And I was amused in your book, you mentioned this practice of asking the group to eat a single raisin. And I did this, and this one lady was talking, and she reached in and grabbed a handful of raisins and popped them all in her mouth at once. And she didn't understand what the point was. And I think people often are so accustomed to, say, eating a handful of raisins, that to focus on one single raisin and the awareness of what it feels like in there. Well, why don't I let you describe what that exercise is about?
Well, it's actually a kind of a golden oldie of initial, awareness practices. And I remember back in the late 90s when it would be one thing that we would engage the groups of patients at the clinic about. Nothing wrong with a handful of them. Raisins are great. But the point, in fact, we used to just do this one raisin thing, then recognize that everybody would just grab some, that we just said, let's have them, let's do a taste test or a sort of experience test. So you start with, eat them, just down them without any thought. And then like, you know what, there's another way to do this. Instead, and we're not trying to starve you, but let's just, in excruciating detail, walk through the experience of the ingestion of a single raisin. And after everybody rolls their eyes, you sort of say, all right, hold it in your hand. What does it look like? What does it feel like? Can you feel the edges? I would usually start doing some stand up and say, do you see the bust of Millard Fillmore in the side of it? So you go, just experience it in different ways. Put it in your mouth. Notice the feel of it, not the taste. Don't bite it yet. I mean, you go like, you can drag this out until the end of the session. But the intention is to go, there is, to look at this as there's more than a mindless throwing back of some food, as an example. So this has all sorts of details you can attend to if you wish to. And everything we have in the world just about has some level of detail that we mostly sort of zoom right by. Yeah.
And especially the breath. Our body will breathe for us. We don't have to pay at all attention. We don't have to pay attention to the breath at all. And we usually don't until we begin a practice like you describe. So what do you have people do? How do they become more aware of their breath?
Usually the first start of any training, and in the book, that's the first start as well. I usually have them start by learning the kind of belly breathing that anybody learns both in yoga or in Lamaze classes. But then you have in meditation, you actually are the next step is to drop any intentional way of breathing, but instead let one's breath settle into its whatever it is in the moment and just observe it. And sometimes even pivot back and forth between, okay, take a big, long, deep breath. Notice what that feels like to have full air. Slowly exhale. Know that technique, but then move back to what's this feel like? The whole point is not so much to engage in a breathing technique. All of that is its own stress management tactic and one I employ in a kind of a mixed cognitive behavioral kind of rescue protocol that is in the book as well as the podcast that I produced called The Mindful Breather. But you can use the breath, and then more importantly, you end up becoming very expert at the way this one aspect of the physical feels in different ways and more aware of it. Instead of just, I don't know, I didn't notice it until I was hyperventilating and now I feel terrible. So yeah, we usually start with the breath because as I say in the book, if you don't have one, call 911. But you have to use something that is familiar. And the kind of cute cheat for it is when people attend to their breath, they generally start working towards slowing it down. So it has a natural calming aspect of it just by the sense that we have a tendency towards wanting to calm ourselves down when we become attendant to something that isn't.
And, you know, if you're doing this by yourself, obviously you're calming yourself down with the breath. But I went to a yoga class out of town. At the end of the class, the woman on the mat next to me thanked me for helping her with her breathing. I didn't intentionally do that. I was just breathing the way I usually breathe. But she thanked me because my relaxed breathing helped her. And I remember one of my students once was at the beach in Hawaii, and this woman was some kind of crisis. And this one was not a nurse, but she said, I sat with this woman and breathed with her. So I think on so many levels, breathing is underestimated, and yeah, in the medical profession. So thank you, doctor, for writing this book.
You're welcome. I hope more people get some help from it.
And the author of this book on practical mindfulness is Dr. Greg Sazima. Thank you, doctor.
Thank you. Take care.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.